Hello, this is Manju Chetani from AVAC. I have been doing a big introduction to you all and I was on mute. I'm real sorry about that and we're getting a little bit of a late start. As you've realized, we are on global mute right now. If you need to unmute yourself later, you do need to press *7. So let me start again. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us this afternoon for an update on current research and rollout of PrEP for women in the U.S. My name is Manju Chetani. I'm from AVAC, and I am delighted to open this call today on behalf of Sister Love and AVAC, who are co-sponsoring this webinar. Also want to thank Lisa Rossi and Polly Harrison, who helped us pull this work on this webinar together, and I hope they'll type in as the discussion continues. This is the first of a series of three webinars we're doing in the next few months around women in PrEP in the U.S. and as part of our work around the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a few seconds. This webinar has been a long time coming. When we talked about the voice results earlier on this year, we had talked about it in the context of a larger discussion, and there was a call from a lot of our working group members to have a webinar devoted to talking about an update on the research around this and what it meant for the U.S. And so we're delighted to be able to bring it to you now. And after a number of things have happened in the U.S., and we can really provide a good update on where we are. And we have three very esteemed speakers who will help us navigate this landscape, Dr. Sharon Hillier from NCN, Dr. Sally Hodder from HPPN, and Dr. Dawn Smith from CDC. And in a minute, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Deirdre Grant, who's going to introduce our speakers and frame the conversation for us. So before we get going, I also want to acknowledge that today is Global Female Condom Day. And so it's an ideal day for us to be having a conversation about what new prevention options can mean for women and what we need to do now to ensure that they have access to them. I also hope everyone on the call is doing something extra special around Female Condom Day. So maybe just a minute on what the U.S. Women and PrEP Working Group is. It's a coalition of more than 50 organizations in the U.S. to build a common understanding of what PrEP as a new prevention tool could be for women in the U.S. Our focus in this working group is how PrEP will be used for HIV prevention by women in the U.S., what data we need now regarding its acceptability and effectiveness, and how it eventually will be promoted, made accessible, and financed. We put together as a group a statement calling for coordinated and timely response by the U.S. government, and we're having ongoing discussions with them around this. And a number of you who've been part of the working group calls have been able to follow up on that. You can access the statement and summary points on it on prepwatch.org, and we have the link over here. And also through that link, you'll be able to learn a little bit more about the group, but also link on to the webinars that are coming up. So before I hand over to Deirdre to introduce our presenters, and our presenters, when it is time for you, if you would just press *7 to unmute yourself. You know, we're having this discussion in a very interesting time where we've had a number of trials on PrEP that have involved women. And from the slide here, the PDF2 study, the Partners PrEP study, showed us that, in the Bancroft-Nussberg study also showed us that PrEP works if you use it. However, we had two studies specifically in women, in FemPrep and Voice, that didn't show that result. And, you know, partially because adherence was such a factor. And so we're really delighted that Dr. Hillier will be talking a lot more about the Voice results with us and what that meant and what the follow-up is. And and Amy Carnelli from FemPrep is also on the line. So if we have any questions about that, we can call on her. Thanks so much, Amy, for being on the call with us as well. In this next slide here is, and you will have copies of the slides, so I'm really not going to go through this in detail, but to say there actually is a lot of work going on ongoing and planned PrEP demonstration studies for women. And this is not just in the U.S., this is in South Africa, in Botswana, in India, in Kenya. And it gives you a good picture of the fact that this continues to be an area that there's a lot of demand and a lot of urgency to get new options for women. And yet we have results that make us a little confused. So I really hope that when we get to the discussion part of this webinar, we can delve into that just a little bit more. And with that, I am actually going to hand over to Deirdre Grant to take us through the real juice of our webinar, which is first introducing our presenters. Thank you very much again to the three presenters for being with us today. Deirdre.
Wonderful. Thank you, Manju. Can you hear me, first of all?
I can. You are not on mute like I was.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, and thank you to everyone who's joined us for this exciting webinar, and we are super excited to have three of the leading voices in this research with us for 90 minutes today, both to present on the research and have a good dialogue about what it means, what else is needed, what's next, and what specifically advocates can do to help move the agenda. And wanted to sort of start looking a bit more specifically to some of the research and a lot of the nitty-gritties of some of the trials, such as VOICE, as Manju mentioned, and really to get a good grounding in what the research has told us thus far, what additional data we expect in the months and years to come, and then transition a bit to some of the later presentations that will focus on sort of what are we doing now and what kind of implementation work we can be doing while we're still learning stuff from the clinical trials. So without further ado, we'd like to introduce our first speaker, who's Dr. Sharon Hillier, who's the co-principal investigator of the Microbicide Trials Network, which was the sponsor for the VOICE study. And just wanted, in terms of logistics for folks, we are going to take any burning questions at the end of each presentation, but hope to save the majority of them for the conversation afterwards. But certainly welcome folks, as the presentations are happening, to put any specific questions to presenters in the chat box on the webinar, and so then we can also sort of see them and integrate the questions as we go. So, Dr. Hillier, if you press *7, you should be unmuted and ready to go.
Hi, it's Sharon Hillier. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Wonderful. All right, so I'm going to take us on a very quick tour through the VOICE results, and hopefully we'll be able to quickly recap those, talk about some of the questions that are still to be answered, but then take it to a little bit higher level and talk a little bit about what VOICE says about women in PrEP, and then a brief summary. So I think everyone on the planet, or at least the 53 people on this call, probably already know that the VOICE study was really designed to compare evaluate the effectiveness of tenofovir tablets, Truvada tablets, and tenofovir gel in a side-by-side comparison, each powered to assess level of effectiveness compared to a matched placebo. So three main questions: which is effective, is each safe, and I always like to remind people the last one, which will women use, because that was from the get-go one of our important questions, and I think we learned answers we didn't want to learn, but we did learn an important answer. So just to remind everyone, women were enrolled between September 2009 and June 2011, so we screened a little over 12,000 women and enrolled 5,029 in Uganda, Zim, South Africa, and half of the women were under 25 years of age, and most, or 80%, were unmarried. So the study was essentially a study where we had five arms, but it was sort of two studies within a single study, because there was the initial randomization to the tablet group, which included 3,000 women, and women were randomized to Truvada, tenofovir, or placebo. And then there was the gel randomization, in which women were randomized to tenofovir or placebo gel. I think we also understand that all women were given an HIV prevention package throughout the study, and that included female condoms. But I have to tell you, there was really very, very poor uptake of female condoms in our study. Very few women actually requested those. So even though it's Female Condom Day, you know, I think we have to have to admit it was a tough sell in VOICE. VOICE stopped testing tablets in September 2011, almost exactly 2 years ago, when our DSMB recommended we stop for futility. And then VOICE stopped testing tenofovir gel at the November 2011 DSMB when we were told that the gel arm was not also significantly protective. So what we found, and when we unblinded the Truvada arm, is that the daily approach, either tenofovir oral, Truvada oral, tenofovir gel used daily, was not the right approach for the population of women in VOICE. None was effective, but at the same time, most participants actually didn't use the product. The thing that most struck me about the data is that the women who were at highest risk, that is to say younger, unmarried women, were the least likely to use the product and were the most likely to acquire HIV. So we had an intervention that was used very well by some older married women in our study population, but tragically, the young women who had the highest incidence of HIV actually were incredibly unlikely to use the products. In our study, the HIV incidence was alarmingly high, 5.7%, which was about twice what we had estimated, and some of our sites in the Durban, South Africa area had incidence rates of 10%. Study retention was really very high. 90%, 91% of women were retained in this study, and as nearly as we could tell, there were no safety concerns with the product. But I think the real headline for us was that the youngest people who needed it the most just simply didn't use it. So when we look at that, the study in a little more detail, we had 334 endpoints in the study. 22 of the women were found to have been infected at enrollment. That is that their PCR of their plasma was positive for HIV, even though they weren't positive by serologic testing, which left us with 312 women who acquired HIV during the study for an overall incidence of 5.7. The next slide really summarizes the incidence rate that's in the highlighted bar at the very bottom, the number of endpoints in each group, and the incidence per 100 woman years of follow-up. And so you can see that the tenofovir tablet had an incidence rate of 6.3, which, if anything, was going in the wrong direction compared to the oral placebo, and you can see why the DSMB stopped that component of the study early. The Truvada tablet was 4.7. The oral placebo, which the reason the two placebos look different is that they were stopped at different times because of the DSMB, and then tenofovir gel at 5.9 and the placebo gel at 6.8. Now, I think everyone sort of knows that the simple headline, which is it didn't work. But I think what we're learning is that we really have to understand who was using it and why, and I think there's a lot more that we're going to learn in the future. So just to remind you what was presented at CROI this year, blood samples were obtained from 773 participants, including the 185 women acquired HIV in the active arms, and we evaluated those for the presence of drug. And what we found is that drug was detected in less than one-third of samples from women in the Truvada and oral tenofovir groups. So which is to say, two-thirds of the time, the women came in, they had their visit, we dutifully gave them their product, and then they simply didn't take it. Drug was detected in less than one-fourth of samples from women in the gel group, but there are differences in sensitivity of the assay because there's much less drug in the blood when you apply a product topically. So we'll have to get more data on local detection of drug before we understand the actual rates of adherence across the arms. But I think one of the most, to me, one of the most sobering pieces of data we had was that more than half of all the women when we looked at all their visits. And remember, these women were seeing over a period of a year and a half to 2 years. Over half the women never had any drug detected in any of their visits, which means that even though women came in, said they wanted to participate in the study, agreed to do it, came back, told us they were taking the product, even at that first visit, at the first three-month visit, they simply never took the drug, as nearly as we can tell, and we have very sensitive assays. And this was in the context of adherence estimates to be around 90% based on what they reported and counting the numbers of applicators and leftover pills they brought back, and even very private a CASI or a computer-assisted questionnaires that were conducted with the women. And so there was a huge disconnect between what we saw and what we observed from their drug levels. So that's summarized in this next slide. Between 86 and 92% said that they had used the products based on applicator pills, 90 to 91% based on what they said, and only 23 to 29% based on the actual drug levels. So young and married women were the least likely to use the product. Drug was detected in only 21% of young and married women versus 50% of older married women in the Truvada group. Okay? So you were twice as likely, more than twice as likely, to have drug in the blood if you were older and married. But the incidence of HIV was 8.8% in young unmarried women versus 0.8% in older married women. So 10 times higher HIV rates. So tragically, overall, even though a lot of women did use the drug, those older women simply weren't the women at highest risk. And so I think it taught us something that was really quite surprising, is that these young women may not have really understood their risk or certainly took great effort to conceal their non-use of study product from us. A lot of people have asked this since, well, how can you not have known what was going on? What in the world? Didn't you have behavioral researchers involved with you? Couldn't you have done something better? How is it possible you did this whole study all the way to the end and never knew that women were being so deceptive about their use of study product? And one of the things I like to point out is that we actually included social and behavioral scientists at every step of our journey, as I know the FemPrep study did. They did a huge amount of behavioral and social science before they started the study. Our behavioral researchers oversaw the modification of the counseling approaches during the VOICE study, and we had heard of great results in the CAPRISA study with the client-centered motivational counseling. We'd also heard about this from the IPREX investigators, and so we actually entirely changed our counseling methods and spent a ton of time increasing capacity at the sites in motivational counseling. And I have to tell you, when we look at the drug adherence data based on drugs in the blood, we found absolutely no effect of all the motivational counseling on adherence to drug product. We had, from the get-go, introduced a community-centered ethnographic study that was proposed by the Behavioral Research Working Group and by our community members, and this was to look at factors and beliefs within women's communities that influence their ability and willingness to use products. And so we involved voice participants and their male partners and CAB members and community stakeholders. And that had all been done, planned, before we understood the results of the study. So when people ask me, couldn't you have known, I just like to say that maybe we should have known, but we didn't know, despite the integration, I think, of a huge investment. So that leaves us with lots of questions. Why did women join the VOICE study and attend 90% of their study visits but not use the products, and half the people never use the products? Did they participate for other reasons? Did they want health services? Were they interested in HIV and testing or STI treatment or cancer screening for cervical cancer? Why did they go to such great lengths to hide non-use? They could have stayed in the study had they told us they weren't using product. And many of these women, where the incidence was the highest and adherence was the lowest, live in really high incidence areas. And yet somehow it was not enough for them to actually desire an HIV prevention product. We've thought a lot about whether or not there was stigma associated with use of ARV-based products in countries where, and I would say everywhere, AIDS is very stigmatized, and concerns that using ARVs for prevention may have inadvertently labeled people as being HIV positive. But even after being told that other studies were finding that regular use was effective, and during the course of the VOICE trial, we had the unveiling of the IPREX results, the unveiling of the VOICE results, the CAPRISA results, and each and every study participant was told, if you use it, it should work. Again, tragically, we found absolutely no uptick or improvement in product use when we look at timing with those announcements. And so it makes us ask, well, if in fact during this study women knew that from the other studies that if they used it, it could work, what do we really need to learn from it? Could they use other prevention products? Was it a problem that the products weren't easy enough to use, or there was too much stigma? So we have set up since another study called VOICE-D, which is a behavioral sub-study which was launched after VOICE, and it's still ongoing. It involves former VOICE participants at 5 sites in Uganda, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. And the first part of it is actually interviewing women in in-depth interviews after they exited the VOICE study and asked them their perception and understanding of their risk, whether or not they were practicing anal sex, how they were using the product. And those interviews revealed that a lot of women said they themselves always used products, but that they knew of others who were not at all adherent. Just a few, a small handful, I would say, actually, talked about their own non-use of product. So we know that even in these in-depth interviews at the completion of VOICE, that we were still getting a very socially acceptable set of responses. In part two, which is just getting ready to launch, we are going to interview between 108 and 140 women who were on active products. And during those in-depth interviews, the women will be presented with their own blood level, drug level tests to be used to really as a way, we say an icebreaker, but in a way, it's a, we hope, non-confrontational way to say it's okay to tell us the truth. We know that there was no drug in your blood, so talk to us about that. And tell us, you know, why you joined the study and what prevented you from having used the product. We hope in the months ahead that we'll be able to answer as well many other questions. As I mentioned, we only tested 750 different participants, but thousands of samples from those. We have now, I think, 160 plasma samples in their freezers, and we're now testing every sample from all 5,029 women, and we'll have a much more rich understanding of how well people use drugs and a lot more understanding of who didn't. We think this is really important because we can't really assess the effects of these drug products on bone health, which was our VOICE-B study, until we understand which women really use drugs. Similarly, we've seen to date no concerning drug resistance. However, we also recognize that most of the virus from the seroconverters probably never saw the drug. That is, there was probably very low adherence. And finally, there was an oral presentation from Jean Marazzo on the effect of tenofovir gel on HSV2 acquisition, and those studies are also ongoing. And we saw a promising trend wherein people who were on active product actually may have somewhat reduced risk of HSV2. So the important point of all of that is just that we are in a stage where we are continuing to do lots and lots of analyses, and we'll hope that we understand more later. So what do we think about Truvada in women? Obviously, as Manju summarized at the beginning of this webinar, it was found to be quite effective in partners PrEP, but the mean age of women in that study was 36, in all were in a committed relationship with a partner they knew was HIV positive, and both partners were certainly aware of the HIV risk. It was also effective in TDF2. And we do know that although it's a very encouraging result, and we don't doubt it at all, the effect size in women was in the sub-analysis, which did not by itself reach statistical significance. So when you look at the results in FemPrep, which was very similar to the voice population, 60% under the age of 25, and 70% stating they perceived themselves at little or no risk of HIV, it's quite similar to what we saw in voice. And when we think about weighing all the evidence, the numbers of women on active product, which are summarized in this slide, we have 873 women on Truvada in Partners PrEP and TDF2, and 1,200 woman years of follow-up. And from FemPrep and Voice, we have 1,800 person years of follow-up. Now, tragically, the two don't agree. But what we can say, unequivocally, I think, is that women, even women living in the same continent, and in a setting where we think people should understand their risk, saw the opportunity to use a prevention product very, very differently. And it's a little bit like giving contraception to married women versus teenagers who don't really think they're going to get pregnant if they have sex with their boyfriends. The most outlandish pregnancy rates are certainly in those young, very sexually active women. And so focusing the efforts to really ensure that young people at highest risk can use prevention products, I think, is what's really critically important. So from my take on this, there's a few take-home messages. Even the most effective product, and I do think Truvada is very effective, will do no good if it's not used or not used correctly. And the women who need safe and effective HIV prevention methods must have an intent and a willingness and a commitment to actually use them every day. I think the low adherence that we saw to oral PrEP and topical tenofovir in our study provided us some real eye-opening clues about real-world use. And we have made us think a lot more about the effect of stigma in using an ARV-based product for prevention in most settings worldwide where HIV infection is highly stigmatizing. And we've thought a lot more about whether asking someone to take something every day is just simply asking too much or asking too much of the people at highest risk. So the results of the VOICE study are clear. Young and married women used the product the least and acquired HIV most, and we still hope to understand why women didn't use the product. But importantly, the VOICE study is quite consistent with FemPrep and send a very strong message that what we need for women is products that they actually want, that they will actually use, and that's why in the MTN we've certainly moved towards use of sustained delivery products like the dapivirine ring and others. Or actually, when we think about what women want, perhaps there would be less stigma with using a product that was a contraceptive but that had a stealth HIV prevention element. So we're doing a lot of exploration, both about delivering drugs in a sustained way, but also developing multi-purpose products that might actually be desirable to women and would provide the HIV prevention tools that they need. So stay tuned. There are more results. The primary results are expected to be published, I'm saying soon. The paper's in it, the VOICE publication, the primary manuscript, is about to be submitted. The VOICE-C results should be reported, I think, by the end of the year. The VOICE-D study, which is looking at those qualitative interviews, we hope to have by mid-next year, as well as the VOICE-B results. And I don't know, our pharmacology lab is swimming in plasma samples. We're not sure when all those drug levels will be done. Well, finally, I'd like to acknowledge all the women who participated in our study and our funders, as of course, at NICHD, NIAID, and NIMH.
Great. Thank you so much, Sharon. That was a great overview. Are there any... we've had a few questions that have come in on the chat box, which some were addressed in the presentation. But if there are any very specific clarifying questions that folks have around voice, you can press star 7 to unmute your line. Otherwise, we're happy to take those in the discussion portion afterwards. So I'll pause a moment for star 7 for any clarifying questions. Okay, great. So now we are going to move on to a little bit bigger picture. So looking at the PrEP research agenda and the HIV Prevention Trials Network, and Dr. Sally Hodder, who's an investigator with PTN, is going to go over some of their PrEP research, but also start with a discussion of their ISIS study, which is very specific and relevant for this particular conversation as we think about women at risk in the U.S. And how PrEP might be an option and delivered and how we reach these women. I'm so happy to welcome Dr. Hodder to the call. And it's, again, star 7 to unmute your line. And hopefully Dr. Hodder is there. I see she's logged into the webinar portion.
Hi, it's Sally Hodder. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me. I want to, over the next 10 to 15 minutes, really briefly review some of the results from the HPTN-064, the ISIS study, and some of the implications perhaps for PrEP, and then focus on what the current HPTN agenda is and discuss four studies that are either in development or actively enrolling in the HPTN on PrEP. So as most of you know, the ISIS study looked at HIV incidence among U.S. women. It seems sort of now that we know the answer, but back when this was really being designed in 2008, believe it or not, there were no good incidence data, and to really just jump in with interventions would have been premature. The objectives are shown there, and not only were the objectives to find the incidence, but also to really describe factors in participants' lives that impacted their risk. The inclusion criteria are shown. There were women 18 to 44 living in areas of the U.S. that had relatively high HIV prevalence, recent unprotected sex, and then there had to be another risk factor, and often that risk factor was really a partner risk factor, substance use, and so forth. The study sites shown on this slide really reflect the highest prevalence areas in women in the U.S. and were up and down the I-95 corridor. And the next slide shows just the baseline characteristics, and I would highlight that the majority of the participants were Black, that rough almost two-thirds were single or divorced or widowed. The annual household income was low, reflecting the inclusion criteria, and food insecurity was high, consistent with the economic setting. I think there are a couple of interesting points here, and one that binge drinking was very prevalent. Intravenous drug use was low at 4%, and we know that the major risk factor for HIV acquisition in U.S. women is heterosexual sex. Though only 4% of women considered themselves commercial sex workers, exchange sex did occur in more than a third of participants, again reflecting the severe economic needs of this population. Anal sex was reported in 40%, suggesting that anything we do for pre-exposure prophylaxis really has to target anal sex as well as vaginal sex. And finally, to the question, did you use a condom at last sex? It didn't matter if it was vaginal or anal. It was 18%. And further qualitative data suggested that women really used condoms inconsistently. There were certain reasons with certain partners that they either did not want to use them or did not have the power to assure that they were used. And even at the end of the study, with free condoms, male condoms, female condoms, lots of counseling, the condom use at last sex only went up to about 33%. The incidence in this study was 0.32%, which, you know, we had the discussion, is this high or is this low? Certainly compared to the incidence rates that Sharon just cited in the VOICE study, this is much lower than that. But nonetheless, if you compare to other places overall in the U.S. for similarly aged women of color, you can see that actually this was much higher than what we usually see in the United States. I think the other point that we found was that not quite 2% of women came into the study being HIV infected and not knowing it, I think really calling attention to the need for further testing. When we looked at the risk factors, substance use, and in this cohort, age, but HIV diagnosis of a partner, not surprisingly, was associated with prevalent HIV infection, though more than 40% of our participants did not know the HIV status of their last partner. So, you know, the HIV HPTN agenda is really one of combination prevention. And I think that PrEP has a very important role there. And just last week at ICAC, there was an interesting study that was presented that looked at IMS, which are prescription data from about 55% of U.S. pharmacies. And if somebody had asked me, do you think that women in the U.S. are going to be using PrEP, I would have thought that probably not. I would have thought that really a small percentage would have been women. But in point of fact, just shy of 50% of the prescriptions believed to be for PrEP were in U.S. women, which I think really brings particular attention to the importance of U.S. PrEP. And clearly, what I think I was surprised is that U.S. women are being prescribed PrEP. If we look at the HPTN PrEP agenda, you can see that really there are three major pillars to this. One is evaluating efficacy of antiretrovirals containing new drugs for PrEP. The second is really developing new agents and new formulations, including long-lasting formulations. And the third is really to develop models to define the role of new agents for PrEP and for dosing. As I mentioned earlier, there are four active studies, one actively in development that I'll just briefly cover. The first is ADAPT. The acronym is shown there, HPTN-067. And this is a study that seeks to answer how does taking oral Truvada intermittently compare to taking tablets daily? Will participants in the intermittent groups have the same coverage of sex events, need fewer tablets, or report fewer side effects? And I think, you know, this study really builds on some of the modeling that was done in the IPREP study that suggested that two doses a week, actually there was a 76% decrease in risk, which went up to 97% at four doses a week. There are three study groups in the 067 study. Those individuals taking the drug daily, those that are taking the drug before and after sex, and then those taking the drug twice a week and a booster after sex. Participants will take no more than 7 pills per week, and all the participants have really been clearly informed that non-daily PrEP schedules have not yet been proven to be effective, and therefore risk reduction counseling and condoms aren't being offered as well. as you can see, this study includes both men and women in all three arms, and is currently being enrolled in Thailand, Harlem, as well as Cape Town. You know, the results will probably be, you know, available not this year, certainly, but hopefully in 2014 or 15. A second study that is actively enrolling is really a collaboration between the HPTN and the ACTG. It is the Next PrEP study. And what this study really does is really look at an approved drug, but Maraviroc, but really Maraviroc has not been used in PrEP. And I think that there are reasons why Maraviroc may be attractive in PrEP. It's concentrated in cervical-vaginal fluid to a greater extent than Truvada, as well as rectal fluid. It's once a day, and unlike Truvada, which is the most commonly prescribed drug for individuals with HIV, Maraviroc is very rarely used in first-line therapy. The study regimens, there are four arms, are shown there, and as you can see, every study arm has an active drug. The primary endpoint is really grade three or greater toxicity. There are a number of secondary endpoints that I'll not go over, but suffice to say that an important point is the impact on bone marrow density, and DEXA scans are being done both in men and women. There is intensive adherence monitoring, including an electronic WISE pill, and there is drug level monitoring as well, and that an interesting exploratory objective really determines whether the PrEP is associated with suppression of HIV replication in colorectal and cervical tissue explants that are taken in a tissue sub-study of this trial. The men who have sex with men portion is almost completely enrolled. Women were added to this study after it was already started and began enrolling in the second quarter of last year. And so about 15% of the women are enrolled. And this is being enrolled in 13 ACTG and HPTN sites throughout the U.S. HPTN-073 is a study of PrEP. It is not in women. It is in black men who have sex with men, and it is occurring in three different cities. And it's really a demonstration project to really gather feedback about the experience from men who elect to use PrEP. Once daily, Truvada is being used. In concert with really client-centered care coordination that is really was piloted as well in the BROTHERS study. The objectives, the main study questions to be answered are shown, and I think it'll be interesting how consistently men who decide to take PrEP take it, and how the men who evaluate the experience using PrEP, and I think it'll be interesting, you know, given some of the data that will be forthcoming in women, to look at similarities and differences as well. This study is taking place in three sites in the U.S., has just started enrolling, and we look really forward to what this important study is going to teach us. And then finally, HPTN-076 is a study that, you know, gets at the safety and acceptability of an injectable PrEP. As you know from Sharon's presentation, two PrEP studies conducted among women have really demonstrated limited adherence and therefore a lack of efficacy. HPTN-076 uses injectable rilpivirine. Rilpivirine is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase, and will be injected every 8 weeks. The questions are, will the women find this acceptable? Is it safe? And is it tolerable? The study, which is nearing protocol completion, will enroll 132 participants. There are two international sites and two U.S. sites, and it will be a double-blinded study. The injectable rilpivirine, which will be given at 8-week intervals for 3 injections, compared to a placebo of saline injection. So, in conclusion, I think existing data suggests that U.S. women are at risk for HIV, are actively being prescribed antiretroviral therapy for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and yet I think that there is a lot we need to learn. The HP10 research agenda assesses novel PrEP agents and administration strategies, and I think really data to be generated from these ongoing studies and soon-to-be-started studies will really address some of the need for increased PrEP options. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Hatter. That was a great overview and a lot of exciting research that's happening at PTN from a range of different studies. So thank you for that.
Can I just thank particularly, I have my thank you and acknowledgement slide, but Jonathan Lucas really provided many of the slides, and I want to give a special thank you to him as well as the HPTN staff and investigators and all of our participants. Thanks.
Absolutely. So we have a couple questions in the chat box, but I think I'm going to hold those unless there's anything that's very specific clarifying question. But I think a number of these here are actually a bit better for a larger discussion. Okay. So I'll pause for a moment. *7 to unmute. Okay, so I think we'll go on to our last presentation, which is coming from Don Smith, who's at the Division of HIV-AIDS Prevention at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. And anyone who's been working in the PrEP field certainly knows Dawn. She's been worked a lot on the clinical research side and now has been leading the effort at CDC in terms of guidelines and implementation, and has graciously agreed to provide us with an update on where we stand with implementation and specifically what's happening in the U.S. context. So without further ado, Dawn, it's *7 to unmute.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Dawn.
Okay, so we're going to talk, now that you've heard a lot about all the trials, we're going to talk a little bit about implementation. So this is just a recap of the results from many of the trials, and the only point of this is that one of the important take-home, there are two important take-home messages for implementation. One is it works. The second one is it only works if you take the drug, that adherence is really critical. Another way to look at the question of adherence is this study from the Partners PrEP trial, in which they looked at the efficacy among women who never had drug measured in their blood, or couples, men or women, in which there was never drug measured in the blood, there was sometimes drug measured in the blood, and there was drug that was always measured at the visits tested. And you can see that most of the efficacy is coming from the participants who were consistent in taking their medication. The last piece of science that's really relevant to implementation is the issue of resistance. Both providers and patients will frequently say, but what about resistance? Aren't we going to cause a lot of resistance? There have been a number of models, and what they've all shown is that while you scale up antiretroviral treatment, if you also scale up PrEP, that PrEP contributes very little to the amount of resistance in a community. Most of the resistance will come from treating people who are HIV positive. And the reason for that is pretty simple. Most of the all of the people who are on treatment have virus in their blood, and when they're exposed to drugs, some of them will not necessarily be adherent or for other reasons will develop resistance. But among the PrEP population, nearly all of them are HIV negative. There's no virus there to become resistant. And so it's only the small group of people who are taking drugs inconsistently and who become infected and have enough drug to drive resistance and not enough to suppress their infection. So we don't think that PrEP resistance is going to be a problem as we scale up PrEP in the United States. So then we want to talk a little bit about, as opposed to the clinical science, about the implementation science. And in the implementation science field, people talk about sort of four stages of the uptake of any new intervention. The first is an initial adoption phase, and we're already well into that. The second one is a diffusion phase, where by word of mouth, it begins to be adopted by other people. And then there's an active implementation phase where you actually go out and try to get people to do the new intervention. And finally, you have a stage of sustainability or institutionalization where it's part of the standard of care, of practice, and it sort of continues under its own speed. This is an example of what early adoption and diffusion looks like in perinatal prevention. So in 1994, early part of 1994, the trial results showing that zidovudine in late pregnancy could reduce perinatal transmission was published, and guidelines were issued, and people began to do that. And what you can see is that there were very high levels of prenatal HIV testing already before that result, but those rates went up even higher when providers had a reason to do the test. And then if you look at the next three, which is looking at whether people received any zidovudine during pregnancy, just the prenatal or just the neonatal doses, you can see that there was fairly rapid uptake. But it took several years to actually reach the levels that we wanted to see in order to drive down perinatal transmission. The last one is a look at for how many pregnancies that were where moms were HIV positive, was it not known whether the mom received zidovudine? And that's the issue of how good a job we do at measuring the uptake of a new intervention. And you can see that in this setting, initially we didn't have very good measures, but we very quickly learned the importance of measuring this, the implementation of this intervention. When we think about PrEP, however, there are two things. There's the same kind of cascade there is for treatment that's from a patient perspective. So you need to identify the patients who need PrEP. You need to select the ones who are interested in PrEP after they hear about it. And then you want to link them to a PrEP program, get them on PrEP, have them be adherent and maintained in an effective prevention mode for a period of time. But unlike perinatal transmission, we have another cascade to deal with, and that is you can only get PrEP if you have providers who are trained, educated, and willing to provide it. And that's an area where we're going to have to do a similar amount of work. In addition to educating patients about what it is, we need to we need to do some more work to get providers ready to deliver it. So what evidence do we have about how far we've come? In a survey that was done in 2010, it was published in 2011 as an abstract. They did a web survey of HIV care providers, members of the American Academy of HIV Medicine. And at that point, the IPREX results were available, but none of the other trial results were available. Well, more than three-quarters had read the interim guidance for MSM. Almost half had had patients who requested PrEP, and about one in five had prescribed PrEP. And at that point, more than a quarter were prescribing PrEP for women, even though we did not at that point have trial results indicating that it was effective. If you look at sort of some of the quality of care indicators, however, about 17% were prescribing triple therapy, even though there's no trial to show that that offers additional protection, and it's certainly likely to offer additional side effects and toxicity. Not all the providers were documenting HIV negative status. Very few were testing for acute HIV infection, which is the situation in which if you start PrEP during acute HIV infection, you do run the risk of generating resistant virus. And many didn't bother to confirm ongoing risk behaviors. They sort of did a quick screen about whether people had ever engaged in a risk behavior, and that was good enough. So that's from the provider side. From the patient side, if you look at the number of patients who are now receiving PrEP as part of any of the demonstration projects or open label extension studies, there are probably about 3,000 patients in the U.S. receiving PrEP in some kind of a post-trial research environment. As was mentioned earlier, Gilead had done an analysis of retail prescriptions using data from about a little more than half of U.S. pharmacies and linking it to claims data from medical records. And they were able to determine that there are PrEP prescribers now in about 700 U.S. cities and in all but one state. I haven't heard which is the one state that they didn't capture. What's interesting is that a third of them were family practitioners or general internal medicine. About 17% were non-physician prescribers. Emergency medicine, for some reason, was also prescribing PrEP. And only about 12% were infectious disease specialists. Among all these providers, more than a third were also prescribing Truvada for HIV treatment. But what that means is that nearly two-thirds were prescribing for PrEP, but were not actively engaged in treating HIV-positive patients. Prescriptions were increasing over the period of the study, and about 14% were for people, younger people under the age of 25. As you heard, about almost half were for women. They had measures for the first quarter of 2013. And if you multiply that by four to get an annual estimate and account for the fact that this was only 55% of the pharmacies, there could be as many as 2,500 PrEP prescriptions written in 2013. In fact, it may be more than that because half of the prescriptions in 2012 were written in the last 3 months, suggesting that things are accelerating in terms of prescribing PrEP. There's been a lot of discussion about why almost half were for women, and there are a lot of suspicions. You can't tell from this particular kind of data what the reason for the prescription was. Part of it may be that there are prescribers who want to give PrEP to women who are HIV uninfected but have an infected partner, especially if they want to conceive. And part of it may be that women seek medical care much more often than men do. And so it may just be a function of them having more opportunities to ask women about their risk behavior, their sexual risk behavior, and identify them as candidates for PrEP. So in order to help speed this along, CDC is engaged in a number of activities. we put out the interim guidance as each risk group was shown to have an effective PrEP regimen. We're now finishing up a comprehensive PHS Public Health Service guideline, and we're encouraging states and larger health systems to develop local protocols for PrEP. We're working a lot on developing tools that clinicians can use to identify which people may benefit the most from the use of PrEP, and we're providing people local prevalence data that they can use to make an assessment about whether somebody is at minimal risk or at high risk, in part because of the HIV prevalence in the community they live in. Clinicians are asking for brief risk reduction counseling protocols and medication protocols, and we're doing some work in that area, and then developing billing codes, because providers are most willing to provide a new intervention if they know how to get reimbursement through insurance. Gilead has established a PrEP patient assistance program. Nearly all insurers will cover PrEP, including many Medicaid programs. But for patients who do not have insurance or whose insurance does not cover PrEP, Gilead will provide free medication to providers to dispense to their patients if the patients have too little income to afford the medication themselves. So what we're working on is making the best use of what we know now to increase awareness and establish linkages to clinical care for the people who might benefit the most from PrEP use, increasing training opportunities for providers who may be interested in offering PrEP to their patients, and beginning a system to systematically monitor PrEP use and its impact on health. As we do this, we'll be incorporating lessons learned from the open label extensions and demonstration projects and continued implementation and clinical research. One of the things that we were asked to talk a little bit about is what are the different kinds of studies that are going on in the implementation era. And so we tend to think of them as falling into three baskets. There are open label extension studies, which is you take the participants in a trial after the trial ends. Now, half of them have received placebo and the other half have received the active drug. You offer them all an opportunity to take the active drug since in the case of PrEP, it was proven safe and efficacious. These studies are done with research consent and with research staff, and they're really designed to learn more about how acceptable PrEP is to people and how willing they are to actually take it regularly once they know the results of the clinical trial. The second kind of study is a demonstration project, and these you go out into the community where you might find high-risk persons and recruit them into a study that looks a lot like the open label study. It is a research consent and research staff, but you're recruiting people who weren't previously in a trial. So, for example, the NIAID demonstration projects are recruiting in sexually transmitted disease clinics, high-risk MSM. And in the United States, all of the demonstration projects and all of the open label extension projects are with men who have sex with men. The third kind of study is an implementation pilot study, which is where you really try to figure out how does this work when it's delivered by the community practitioners to participants in the community as a clinical service. So it's a form of health services research in which you go into a clinic system. You train the staff, you allow them to enroll, to put patients on PrEP, and then you monitor sort of how they're doing. Are they putting high-risk people on PrEP or low-risk people on PrEP? Are they doing the HIV testing at the frequency that it seems to need to be done? And what's the outcome in community or real-world context? CDC is now embarking on one of these implementation pilot studies, and that study will have about half the participants will be women at high risk of HIV acquisition. So thank you for spending time on this call and for any help you can give us in understanding how to make this tool more available and better used by women, particularly in the U.S.
Dawn, thank you so much for that fantastic presentation, and also thank you very much to Sharon and Sally for theirs. We have about 20 minutes left for discussion, so I want to go right to it. We've had a number of questions come in through the chat, but I want to encourage those who send questions to press star 7 and ask your question directly to any of our presenters here. Any specific questions or any for the broader discussion? So star 7 to ask your question directly. You can also email your question to avac@avac.org, or if you're one of those folks who use Twitter, you can also tweet your question.
So hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Okay, so this is Kate McQueen, and I want to say thank you to the presenters, all three of them, you know, for this really great update and overview. I want to pick up on something that Dawn mentioned at the end of her talk and then bring it back around to Sharon's presentation earlier. And in Dawn's talk, she closed with by talking about these different kinds of post-trial PrEP studies, open label extension, demonstration project, implementation pilot, and how they move further and further away from a research context. And when I was listening to Sharon's talk, one of the things that struck me is, you know, the fact that the women in the trials, although in one sense they had the opportunity to potentially try a prevention product, in fact, all of those trials were blinded, placebo-controlled. And so the factors that may have been deterring them from adherence might actually be quite different from what we would see in these subsequent rollout kinds of studies where we're saying, we know this works and we're giving it to you. And so I was just wondering whether Voice was doing anything to look at that factor, because I do worry about overgeneralizing about how women will or will not make decisions related to their risk in the context of a placebo-controlled trial.
Thanks, Kate. Sharon, do you want to
say? Thanks. You know, it's interesting, and I guess hindsight 2020, but you may or may not remember, we did another study rolling up to MTN-003 or the VOICE trial, and it was called MTN-001. And it was an open-label crossover study of oral tenofovir and vaginal tenofovir done in Uganda and two sites in South Africa. And what we saw even in that study, even though women told us that they used it 90% of the time and it was open-label, everybody got active product, that when we went back and did the final analyses of the samples to see what proportion of people were actually using drug, it was around 50%. So even in that setting, we have found that adherence was certainly what you would consider to be quite suboptimal, and that was a highly selected population of participants in a phase one study. So I don't want to overgeneralize, but I will say that I think the bulk of the data that's come to us, and as we continue on in our quest to develop prevention products, I think it is critically important to not ascribe all of this to some notion that people, in fact, didn't take the drug because they weren't sure it was the active product. I honestly think that the reasons may have nothing at all to do with PrEP, but have a lot to do with why women in medically underserved communities during trials access health care. So, you know, it's entirely possible that a lot of people join studies who don't really have a desire for those products. And so, I think it has caused us to think a lot more about why people's motivations for joining studies and what they really want out of the studies. And, you know, it's quite interesting, but I don't think it's just that somehow there was some worry that they weren't getting active products, because honestly, even in MTN01, our adherence was low as well, and that was open label.
Thank you, Sharon. Any other questions? Star 7 to unmute yourself. Please say your name and ask your question.
This is Polly Harrison. Excuse me. I have a question about, I think it's to Sally, about the ICAC data. Those data are all about prescribing, but I may have missed something, but I didn't hear anything about the use. Why are they prescribing? What do we know about the use? What do we have, 50% of women of that prescribing group are female or women? Do we know anything about how adherent they are? Do we know anything about whether they asked the prescriber for PrEP or whether this was a prescriber decision? I guess I'm perhaps we don't know anything, and perhaps it would be hard to find out, but I thought I would ask.
Excuse me, this is Steve Wakeford. Can I add a question to that? Maybe they can be answered at the same time.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I'm wondering if, as we look at the demographics and what we do know about the women that are subscribing in the U.S., if their demographics might be compared to the women that are enrolling in HPTN studies, and if do we have any way of getting additional information about those women from either Gilead or from the pharmaceutical industry?
So this is Sally. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
As Dawn mentioned, this was IMS data. That's retail pharmacy data from a little more than half the pharmacies. So really the granularity of that data is limited. Now, what was done, and this was really just a first cut of the data that took the prescriptions for Truvada from about 6 months before FDA approval of PrEP till the first quarter of 2013, which was 9 months after. And what it did is really exclude individuals who had hepatitis B diagnoses, certainly HIV diagnoses, who had a diagnostic code for post-exposure prophylaxis. So, with those data, that is really all we know. It did not look at refills. There's certainly no ability to really look at adherence to answer Polly's question directly. But I do think that the next step for these data are to really, focus down on the women and look more thoroughly at the age and some of the demographic data which will be available. This was just a cut of the population overall, men and women. So to answer Steve's question directly, so one could, actually then look and compare with HPTN study demographics in this country.
Hello, this is Stephanie Dio, and I have a couple of questions. My first question is when you were looking at the VOICE study trial, did you take into consideration that women often do not have negotiation choices and in the protection process for sex, and was that taken into consideration in the results of this study? And secondly, I'm just wondering, we're doing studies that are looking at women that are having sex with positive men who are, women are HIV positive, but are we going to, or is there in plans in the future for looking at women who are HIV positive whose partners are HIV negative?
Okay. thank you for that. Sally or Dawn?
Relevant to your second question, to my knowledge in the HPTN, there are, though we have certainly talked about it, there are no active protocols being designed to really look at that population. I think the other question was probably for Sharon for voice.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I can answer the question. Did we take into account coercive sex or the fact that women can't control sex? I mean, the products were all used on a daily basis. So, yes, I'm sure that many of the women, certainly from our interviews, we understand that many of the women in our study populations are in difficult situations where they cannot control when they have sex and sometimes have coercive sex. However, the products, including gel product, were to be used daily, not around the time of sex. So I'm not exactly sure what the issue was. The second part of your question about transmission from HIV-positive women to HIV-negative men, of course, that was tested and shown to be quite effective in the Partners PrEP study. So I think we do know that works.
Thank you, Sharon. Star 7, again, for your questions. We have time for a few more.
I have a question. This is Ann Schwartz. I have a question regarding specific clinical guidelines for when to prescribe PrEP for women. Do they exist, and can we take the information from the studies to make that determination?
Hi, this is Dawn. Yes, there's an interim guidance document online for the use of PrEP with heterosexual men and women.
Okay.
And it includes language of who may be the most appropriate candidate.
Thank you.
Great. Star 7, any other questions? Deirdre, as we're waiting for any other questions, I wonder if you want to refer us to any of the conversations that happened at the recent conference.
Hi, this is Tamara Johnson calling in. I had a question for Dawn Smith.
Go ahead, Tamara.
Okay, so the question I had for Dawn is 47, almost 50% of women were being prescribed PrEP. I guess what I'm wondering, do you have any information on whether those women were at risk for HIV, whether, you know, more demographics on them? I mean, you had mentioned that they might be in disconcordant couple relationships and seeking contraception. I'm wondering more about women who might be medically underserved and how much access they might have to PrEP prescriptions.
The way that, first of all, we didn't do this analysis. This analysis was done by Gilead Sciences. And the way that they do the analysis is they have a database that links aspects from the billing records of people in care to aspects, to prescriptions that were provided to those patients. And it's done in such a way that, you know, you can't identify individual people in the analysis data set that you get. Very often, demographic factors are missing in that data. For example, you will almost always have age. You will clearly have location. You may have insurance status because it will be in the billing record. But you may not have race, ethnicity. And you almost never will have any indication of the reason for prescribing PrEP. It simply says that the patient received Truvada, doesn't have HIV infection, doesn't have hepatitis C infection, and received it for a period of time that is inconsistent with non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis. So you really can't tell whether it was for injection drug use or a partner who is high risk or high risk behavior on their own part. So I think, you know, this is very preliminary analysis, and it's one way of looking at how much PrEP use is going on. But it certainly doesn't answer all the questions that we want to know about what the current state of PrEP use is in the United States.
Okay, thank you. And then the question I had for Sharon Hillier and the voice trial was there was discussion about the majority of women being under 25. I was wondering if you have more information about how much younger they were. I mean, do you have it broken out by different age groups, 15 to 18, 18 to, you know, 25, you know, that sort of thing? And if those women, if those young women, I heard sort of a discussion about the possibility of longer-term, you know, antiretroviral products in women's systems, like long-term injectables. Is that what women are asking for? Is that what they're seeking? Or we don't know.
Thanks for your question. Yeah, we know exactly how old everybody was. The half the women were less than 25. Half the women were greater than 25. They were all, the half that were less than 25 were all 18 to 25 because we didn't have adequate safety data in adolescents to include adolescents in that particular study. So it was, so they weren't very young teens for sure. So the issue, it wasn't like, it was really being young and unmarried were the elements that really increased women's risk, but it wasn't extreme youth. It wasn't being 15 or 16. And I'm sorry, your second question was?
The second was, were women seeking long-term injectables when you did the in-depth interviews? Are those the kinds of things that they were saying that they wanted?
It's safe to say that, you know, in the in-depth interviews, we didn't ask, like, would you rather, if you could have had this as an injection, would that have been better? We didn't really get into that specific issue. You know, what we are hearing is that there was a great deal more stigma than we thought about the use of antiretrovirals. That is, women reported that if family members or household members saw that they had tablets, that there was a concern that they were actually infected and were not divulging their infection to the family members or their partners. We heard that that there was just a lot of a desire for the study services related to getting the frequent HIV checks, STI checks, and that was something that they really desired. What they did say is that that they knew that staff would have done better if they would have known their drug levels were getting measured, and they thought they could get away with it, more or less. Mm-hmm. And the notion now as we're moving forward is much more to having an understanding of the critical role for some of this of directly observed therapy. And, you know, the notion that I think still that there wasn't, honestly, I have to say, there wasn't a desire in some cases to actually use the product. There just wasn't. So that is to say, people signed up for the study, but they really didn't necessarily have any desire or intention to actually use the products.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for your question and that great answer. I think we've addressed all of the questions in the chat box. Except for there's one, and we just have a couple minutes remaining. It was specific to the voice study, but I think it's sort of a general question that's come up a lot in some of the focus group conversations that advocates have had around, you know, this research has been done largely internationally, and that's where the efficacy data is from, and not in the U.S., which is what we're speaking to specifically today. And the question was around, you know, will there be a study done domestically? And I think that speaks a lot to sort of the next step and what Dawn was describing in terms of the implementation pilot and the demonstration projects to figure out how these results would apply in the U.S. context. And was wondering, Dawn, if you are able to share any additional information on the timeline for the implementation pilot, if not when it is, you know, maybe not when it's going to start exactly, but the duration, or if there's any additional information available yet.
Sure. The protocols are with IRVs at the moment, so we hope to get started early in 2014.
Yep.
And we have funding for 3 years.
Oh, great. Thank you. And I guess actually I had one question actually for Dr. Hodder in terms of the ISIS cohort. I was wondering, is there been any discussion of thinking about doing any kind of demonstration project or any work specifically with the women in ISIS around PrEP? Given the risk.
There's really not been a discussion about doing an HPTN-sponsored PrEP around women who participated in 064. But that said, there is a consortium that includes not all of the sites in the HPTN 064 that really are working on and have a concept that's being reviewed of implementing PrEP in similar population for those women who really are increased risk in these areas. And, you know, I we'll see if it goes. But I do think it points out that, you know, if you look in the United States, that there, you know, it's not a generalized epidemic. There are parts of the United States where individuals are really at increased risk, and for a number of reasons, and it's really those women that we'd like to target, and I think the demonstration projects are really just the way to go on that.
Great, thank you. So we are at the end of our 90 minutes, so thank you to everyone. Thank you to our excellent presenters and the great questions, and I know my colleague Manju, who keeps getting bounced off for some reason, so she might be on the line, but just before any final thanks from her, just wanted to, for those of you who are still on the web interface, there's information on next month's webinar, which is around PrEPception, so serodiscordant couples using PrEP to reduce transmission risk while achieving pregnancy, and have a great lineup there, and you can find more information at prepwatch.org. And we'll also be sending email follow-up to everyone who registered for this webinar, including the slides and the recording, and also details on how to register for next month, which is on October 28th. And, yeah, again, if there's any interest or further information that folks have about the working group, feel free to email avac@avac.org. And just thanks again to all of our excellent presentations. And Manju, I'm not sure if you're back on, if you wanted to say anything. And also to thank our partners in this effort, and Sister Love, who co-sponsored this with us.
Thanks so much, Dia. Just to repeat, thank you to everyone and Sister Love, and we hope you enjoy and have a lovely rest of the week, everyone.
Thanks, all.
Thank you. Please stand by.